chapter 21, verses 18 through 19. I'll be reading from the ESV. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me.
Good evening. How are you guys? Good. I'm so glad to be able to speak to you tonight. I feel like I'm really loud. Am I really loud? Maybe it's just that I'm so used to coming up and not having any, but as long as you're okay with it, I'm okay with it. I really appreciate everyone who has already given and helped out and volunteered to help with our SOS program coming up in May. We're really excited about what we are planning this year. If you didn't read in the bulletin last week, our plan is to make this a summer-long effort in a way, and we want to have constant or regular contact with the folks who come visit us on May 16th. We want to be able to follow up with them, continue to provide for some of their physical needs, so we can reach their most important need, which would be a relationship with Christ. And so in doing that, we have a lot of opportunities to be involved. We're going to have another organizational meeting. We're going to let the Johnson City Schools get through spring break, and then we'll have another organizational meeting probably towards the end of this month. But we're still looking for some help. If you can provide a service that you think would fit in with what we're doing. Some of the things that we already are doing is health screenings, and we've got a lot of medical professionals in the congregation that have said we can do glucose, we can do blood pressure, and a lot of those kinds of things. So I'm really excited about that. We've talked about HR, a professional clinic, and people are going to have volunteered to do mock interviews and resume coaching and some things like that. I think that's going to be really powerful for our community. If there's things that you can do that might fit in with that, that would allow us an opportunity for a one-on-one time with some people from our community. If you've got, you know, a computer that you can stick in somebody's car and read check engine lights, that might be something that could benefit our community. If you can cut hair, we'd really like to be able to have some folks who can cut hair that day. But any kind of things like that you think you might be able to pitch in and help with, that would be greatly appreciated. What if you could see the future? Have you ever wanted to see the future? In one of my favorite movie franchises, the Back to the Future movie franchise, in the second Back to the Future movie, Marty McFly, he goes to the future and he buys a sports almanac. And the reason he buys the sports almanac is because he wants to go back in the present day, look up and see which team won the World Series or the Super Bowl and make some bets, and he's going to profit from knowing the future. That's his idea of being able to see the future. Of course, he buys that almanac and everything goes crazy because of that. Several years ago at High Rock, we had a whole retreat that was themed I can see the future, and the idea of I can see the future, we got that from speaking to an ER doctor who told us, I can see the future. And what he was talking about is, you know, he would walk into a room where he'd see a patient, a man who may be in his 60s, who's been a smoker for most of his life. And the last 10 years have been particularly rough. He's connected to oxygen, he's struggling for breath, he's got constant respiratory infections, and he doesn't have the lung capacity to do a lot of things that we take for granted. And here he is in his ER, and he's dying from chronic emphysema, from COPD, but he would still disconnect his oxygen long enough to have another cigarette. And in another room down the hall, he said he'll meet a 25-year-old young man who's in there with just a persistent cough. The young guy's been a smoker since his late teens, And he tells the doctor, "I'm okay. It's just a little respiratory infection." The doctor says, "No, man, you need to quit smoking now, because I can see your future, and your future is down the hall, and it doesn't look that good." He says, "I can see the future." And in a lot of ways, doctors can see the future. In a lot of ways, there's a lot of people in life. If we talk to some counselors, if we talk to some therapists, if we talk to school counselors, they can see that path. They can see that trajectory that will launch a person into their future if they don't break a cycle, if they don't break a path, if they don't stop doing what they're doing and change direction. We can see the good future sometimes for some people. We can see great trajectories that certain people are on, great paths that people are tracking to, and we can say, you know what, the future is bright for this person. We don't know exactly what that future will hold, but we know if you keep doing what you're doing, if you keep taking these steps, you're going to have success in your life and in whatever you're planning on doing. I wanted to talk about people in the Bible that saw their future, and I really appreciate Steve leading that last song. We didn't have any conversation before that. He saw the future and knew that this was going to be the lesson. He said, in the chorus it says, "Roll back the curtain of memory now and then. Show me where you brought me from and where I could have been." And I really appreciate that line in that song, because tonight as we talk about some folks from the Bible who are able to get a glimpse of their future, I think that's going to be really powerful, of seeing not only where they are, but where they could be. And God has done so much, and I think when we see the future that was shown to some of these folks in the Bible, I think it can give us a lot of different emotions. If we were able to see our future, I think sometimes the emotions that we could have about our future, and of course this is all abstract, because how could we see our future, right? But let's just say that we could. I think that there would be a lot of similar emotions to looking back at our past, right? We look back at our past, and there's fond memories in our past. There's embarrassing memories. There's memories that make us sad. There's memories that make us angry. There's memories that make us embarrassed, that we don't want to see. And if we could see our future, there would probably be some of those things too. There would probably be things that, "Oh, that's so great, I want to embrace that." And there's some things that we'd see that we'd say, "Oh, no. That can't be me," right? I want to look at a few people. I want to start with Abraham. Abraham saw the future, and he trusted God. God told Abraham exactly what his future was going to look like. In Genesis chapter 17, God promises 99-year-old Abraham. And in this discussion, in this promise, you know, Abraham's name was changed from Abram to Abraham. But he tells 99-year-old Abraham in verse 4 that he's going to make Abraham the father of a multitude of nations. And obviously for Abraham, there has to be a leap of faith to trust God on this promise. He's 99 years old. By the time Isaac, the promised son, was to be born, Abraham would be 100 years old. His wife would be 90 years old. And when Abraham first hears this, the Bible tells us that he fell on his face laughing. And I want, if you can just picture that for a second, a 99-year-old man falling on his face is generally not a good event. Abraham is so overcome by this ludicrous thought that here he is, that going to be a 100-year-old father, that he falls on the floor laughing. And you might think, how much trust does Abraham really have in this situation? If God says you're going to be the father of many nations, he falls on the floor, he starts laughing. First of all, how much trust does he need? Because God says this is going to happen. Whether Abraham trusts him or not, it's going to happen. How much trust does he really need? But then secondly, he laughs at that promise. So how much could he absolutely be trusting him? But it continues and goes on to say that Abraham did trust God, and all the men in his house were circumcised, including the 99-year-old Abraham. And there's obviously a certain amount of commitment involved in that. And Abraham trusts, and it's not the only time he sees his future and trusts God. Because in Genesis chapter 22, now he has his son Isaac, this promised son who's going to be going to be part of this promise of being Abraham being the father of many nations. And God tells Abraham to sacrifice Isaac in verse 2 of Genesis chapter 22. And Abraham is probably having some trouble seeing what the future is going to look like. All he knows is that the future is not going to involve his son. But he trusts God. He trusts God to the point that it only takes 9 verses to cover the time that God says you need to sacrifice Isaac and the time when the angel stops the knife from Abraham. Greg Ryan taught the Young Families class a few weeks ago, and he made this point that the angel tells Abraham that you did not withhold your son from God, meaning that God knew Abraham's heart right then, and that in Abraham's heart, he went through with the sacrifice. It wasn't that he was waiting for someone to stop him. It wasn't he was thinking twice. He knew that God had a plan. God's never going to ask us to kill one of our children for him, but he will ask for sacrifices that won't be easy sometimes. Maybe it's sacrificing time on a Saturday morning to come help our community with SOS. Maybe it's sacrificing some time a couple months from now to attend VBS and to help out with VBS, maybe teach a class. Maybe it's taking a couple hours on a Monday night to be part of our Monday Night for the Master program. Maybe it's just getting to bed a little earlier on Saturday night so that we can be a part of Bible class on Sunday mornings. You know, and I know some of these sacrifices are real sacrifices for folks. I know, some of these things, a lot of these things that, I can tell you to try to be a part of Monday Night for the Master, but it's been a long time since I've been able to be a consistent part of Monday Night for the Master. I know that the sacrifices are real and hard depending on things you have going on in your life. But if you're not sacrificing, we have to remember that God isn't asking for one of our children. He's asking for a little bit of time. He's asking for service. He's not asking for one of our children, but God did give his child for us. Can we see a future? Can we see a future like Abraham, a future of sacrificial service? And can we, just like Abraham, see that kind of future and trust God and know that our sacrifice will be worth so much more than that small thing that we're leaving behind? We can't have a discussion about Bible characters who saw the future without talking about Joseph. In Genesis 37, we see a 17-year-old Joseph who's having dreams that foretold his future, and these dreams made his brothers pretty mad. He dreamed that his brothers were going to be bowing down before him, and they didn't like that. So in verse 8 of chapter 37, it says they hated him. They hated him because of these things he was telling him. And so we know how the story goes. His brothers sold him to Egyptians, and while in Egypt, Joseph flourishes. He's a good worker, and he becomes the head of Potiphar's house. And Potiphar is an officer of Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world at the time. So Potiphar lives well. He has a beautiful house. In verse 4 of chapter 39 of Genesis, Joseph is the head over Potiphar's house. And Potiphar's a powerful man. He doesn't just have a beautiful home. It's very likely that his wife is one of the most beautiful women in Egypt. In verse 7 of Genesis chapter 39 says, her eye was cast on Joseph, and she wanted him. Now later in Genesis, we can read about Joseph being in prison and reading dreams and foretelling the future of some of his fellow inmates, and we see him deciphering the dreams of Pharaoh himself. But he didn't need a dream to see the future and to see what his future with Potiphar's wife would be. And it says in verse 12, she caught him by the garment one day and told him, "Lie with me." And in that instant, Joseph saw his future and he ran. He saw what his future looked like and he says he fled. And sometimes, you know, we're presented with opportunities that we need to flee from. Paul uses the same word that it says there in Genesis when it says Joseph fled this situation. Paul uses that word flee in talking to the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18, when he says to flee sexual immorality, get away from it, run away from it. And we think everyone in this room probably knows of marriages and families that were destroyed by husbands or wives who had an opportunity to flee, and they didn't flee. And people who thought, now this is harm. It's just a little harmless flirtation. You know, nothing's going to come of this. This will be okay. I have a friend who destroyed his marriage because he delivered a pair of sunglasses to a female coworker and to her hotel room, and things mushroomed out of that. Completely harmless. Flee when you have the opportunity to flee. We have to be careful to allow ourselves to see what the future can look like in certain situations, not just sexual immorality, but all kinds of sin. The Bible tells us the devil is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, and we need to treat him like that. We need to treat sin like that. It can be very dangerous, and especially if we say, oh, this is harmless. I can kind of skirt around this. We need to be able to see what a future will look like, and when necessary, we need to flee. What about Lot and his family? Lot's wife saw her future, and in seeing her future, she missed her past. Tim referenced this morning the destruction of Sodom, and Lot's son-in-laws, when Lot went and told his son-in-laws, they thought he was joking. They thought he was joking, and they when he came to wake him and said, "It's time to go," no big deal. You know, I think about this scenario almost like a movie. Things are getting more and more tense. And as you read this, as you read through this story and you read what's going on with the men of the city knocking on the door and asking for these men and asking for sons-in-laws and daughters and all this, it just seems like the tension is being ratcheted up and ratcheted up. And you see Lot's sons-in-law and they're like, "No, this is no big deal." I think about the Benghazi movie, 13 Hours, and how that tension just builds through the whole movie, and you wish you could warn these guys through the screen, like, you don't know what's about to happen. And early on in that movie, they go to the embassy, and there's soldiers guarding the embassy, and they're very confident in all how the embassy is being guarded, and the CIA comes in to check on them and says, "Well, we have some intelligence that says that there may be some things brewing. Oh, no, we got this." And then, of course, over the course of the movie, they didn't have it. And it gets scarier and scarier. And that's kind of what I think when I read the account of what's going on in Sodom. Like, this is reaching a boiling point, and no one seems to be that concerned. In fact, as we continue to read, it says, you know, this evac of Sodom is necessary. And in verses 15 and 16, it says, "As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, 'Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city.'" But it says he lingered. He lingered. You know, sometimes I joke with my wife, if our house was on fire, she would be the last one out because she would be turning off all the lights and making sure everybody used the bathroom, you know, before we left. We linger sometimes. You know, we might be a minute or two late for church sometimes. We might be lingering. We have three kids who like to linger. And it says Lot was lingering. Here it is. You know, your house is on fire. Your hair is on fire. You need to get out of here, Lot. And he lingered. And he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful upon him. So Lot lingered, so they took him and his family by the hand, they drug them away, and as they're fleeing, Lot's wife is still lingering, isn't she? She's not physically lingering. She's not physically lingering to turn off the lights or make sure everybody used the bathroom, but she's lingering in her heart. She's lingering in her mind, and she sees a future in a new city, and she's missing her old city. Yeah, it was a godless city. Yeah, it was terrible, but she loved it. And she lingered, and her mind lingered, and her heart lingered, and she looked back, and she suffered the same judgment as those in the city. It's hard for us to leave the world in the world, isn't it? The world is so enticing at times. Come on, be a part of the world. Don't you want this set of friends? Don't you want to be part of this world? Don't you want to run in these circles? Don't you want the honor and the prestige and everything that comes with it? And we have to live in this world. But just because we're living here doesn't make it our home. Our home is far away from here. And just like Lot and his family, we're only here for a little while. And when it's time to go, there's going to be nothing to miss about this world. And if our heart is lingering, we will partake in the judgment that is meant for the world. I love seeing how active the Father is in pulling out his children from destruction. He grabs them by the hand and says, "Let's go." He wants us with him. He doesn't want us to be stuck dwelling in the past. He wants us to come with him to something so much better. What about Jonah? Jonah thought he saw the future. Jonah thought he saw the future in Nineveh, and that future scared him. And I can identify with Jonah, I think, from time to time. How many of you have ever had a responsibility that either scared you or you just didn't want to do, and so you kept putting it off? I just turned in my taxes on Friday, and I'm still not sure they're all turned in right. I'm pretty sure there's still going to be a couple things I need to do. Or how many of you have ever been given a task at work to complete, and suddenly you keep finding all these more urgent jobs that are necessary that you need to tend to before getting on that task? Like, oh, you know, the boss told me to do this, but I just noticed been a long time since somebody changed out all those coffee filters. We need to get right on that. And so things like this happen, and here's what's going on with Jonah. He sees a potentially scary future when God tasks him with going to Nineveh in Jonah chapter 1. So in verse 3, Jonah runs away. Now what happens in our secular life when we run away from our problems? Most of the time they get worse, right? That check engine light in the car, I'll get to that tomorrow. And then one day we're stranded on the side of the road with a repair that's too expensive to deal with. Or maybe the young man in the ER with the persistent cough that, I'm okay, doc, I'm young, I'll live forever. When Jonah runs away from his responsibility, things get so much worse. He spends 3 days and three nights in the belly of a fish. And we don't know a ton about Jonah's life other than the book of Jonah, but I'd venture to guess that he would rank this pretty close to rock bottom in his whole life, if it wasn't rock bottom. We don't know if he had other experiences inside the belly of a fish, but I don't think he did. If he maybe had 4 or 5 nights, maybe that would be his rock bottom, but otherwise I think 3 nights in the belly of a fish is Jonah's rock bottom. And when he gets there, he prays. And for a lot of us, it takes rock bottom to bring us to our knees. In Bible class this morning, we talked about, Scott made a really good point, that when we pray for certain things in our life, when we pray to become a different person, sometimes we have to be ready for that. If we pray for humility, God can humiliate us. He can humble us. He can bring us to our knees. And this is what's happening with Jonah. And he prays. He hit rock bottom, and in his lowest moment, he begs God for help. And we wonder how many times, if rock bottom could have been avoided for Jonah, if he had done it right the first time, if we had gone ahead and got that check engine light checked out the first time, if we had stopped smoking when we were 25 instead of waiting until we were in our 60s, and if we had just trusted God the first time. There's probably a lot of stories in this room and in my own life too where we can look back and say, I should have trusted God the first time. It would have saved me a lot of regret. Would have saved me a lot of bad memories. Should have trusted God the first time. Jonah could have avoided 3 days and nights in the belly of a fish if he just did what God said. See the future. I want to finish with Peter tonight, because Peter saw his future and he was revitalized. For a lot of his life, Peter thought his future was his present. He didn't see growth opportunity because he thought he was already grown. He thought he had it all. He thought he was ready. He thought he was fully mature. And in Matthew chapter 14, verse 29, Peter jumps out of the boat to walk on water to meet Jesus. And one verse later, he's crying out for help. I'm sinking. Master, save me. Then, of course, we have Peter in Matthew chapter 26, verse 33, telling Jesus, even if all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. My future is now. I'm ready. I'm complete. I'm a perfect servant. I'm everything you need, Jesus. And Jesus tells him in that setting, on this very night, before the rooster crows 3 times, or before the rooster crows, you'll deny me 3 times. Jesus tells Peter his future, and Peter refuses to hear it. In fact, in verse 35, Peter says, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. A few verses later, Peter really is ready to die for Christ. He pulls out his sword and he aims for the throat of one of the officers arresting Jesus in the garden, but clips an ear instead. This wasn't Peter's trial. Think about it. Peter's trial was not, was he ready to die for Jesus? He pulled out his sword. I think he expected several more swords coming back his direction. The question wasn't whether or not Peter could die for Jesus. That's not what Jesus needed right then. He needed Peter to say he knew him. He needed Peter to confess him. Just like God doesn't need us to sacrifice a child. He just wants us to follow him. And sometimes the big sacrifices are easier than the little sacrifices. And Peter's ready to die for Christ, but he isn't ready to live for Christ in that moment. Because we know what happens as the night moves along. Hey, aren't you one of him? Aren't you one of them? No, that's not me. No, I'm sure I saw you with him. No, not me. Well, you sure talk like one of them. And so Peter curses, uses all the swears he can think of so that they'll know that's not him. He doesn't talk like one of those guys. He must not be with him if he's going to talk like that. And in Luke 22:61, the rooster crows and it says, the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter is crushed. Brian Ketchum spoke at the College House Tuesday night, and he brought up the breakfast scene in John chapter 21, where the disciples are fishing, and Jesus is on the beach, and he asked Peter 3 times, Peter, do you love me? The last time that Peter had seen Jesus was Luke's account. The last time he'd seen him alive was Luke's account when Jesus looked down at Peter. Now he's saying, Peter, do you love me? The last meaningful conversation that they had, Peter was saying, I'll die for you. I'll do anything you need me to do. And now Jesus is saying, do you love me? And Peter is not able to answer in the affirmative to the same degree that Jesus is asking him, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you have agape love for me? And it's tearing Peter up because he wants to say yes. Everything inside him wants to say yes. He just knows that when he was put in that situation, he failed. Brian mentioned this Tuesday night, and I really appreciated this. In verse 18 and 19 that was read for us a second ago, Jesus has this to say to Peter. He tells him his future. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. In Peter's rock bottom moment, when it looks like Peter may have given up and gone back to fishing, When Peter knows that he can't say, Jesus, I love you in the way you need me to love you, Jesus tells Peter his future. And he says, it's okay, Peter, because you're going to get there, and I need you for who you are right now, but I need you for who you're going to be. And I think about, for Peter, this has got to be the one time in human history where someone is told, you're going to die a martyr's death. And it was a relief to them. Because Peter is thinking, oh, good, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. Like all these things that I can't do, you're telling me, you're showing me my future and saying, ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm going to do exactly what I want to do and what you want me to do. And he was revitalized. And we see Peter as a different person throughout the New Testament after that moment. We see him delivering the first gospel sermon on the day of Pentecost, and we see him in the books of 1 and 2 Peter talking about when he dies, about the things that he's learned over his life. Now, Peter still made mistakes, I'm sure. But Peter understood he had a future, and that his future was with Christ, and that he was going to make it. And I look at that and I think, how awesome. You're not who you are right now, but I can take you there. And that's encouraging for me, because I blow it sometimes, and I blow it really bad sometimes. And I think about folks in this congregation that I look up to. And I think about, I was glad to hear this morning the news that Terry Billingsby was installed as an elder in his congregation in Florida. And I wonder if Terry, or even if some of our own elders or leaders in this congregation, if in their teens or 20s or 30s, if they ever had moments where they thought, I can't do this. I just can't do this. I'm not strong enough. I've had those moments. Those Peter moments when part of me says, I want to die for you, Jesus, but then he doesn't want me to die for him. And I probably could, in certain moments, I probably could die for him, but that's not what he wants. He doesn't want me to die for him. What he wants is to live for him. What he wants is something so much more insignificant, and I fail him with the small task when he says, listen, I don't need you to die for me. I need you to live for me in this moment where everyone in the room is gossiping, and I need you to be the one that stands up and says, we can't do this. I need you to be the one when that situation is so volatile that you need to be the one that doesn't lose their temper, that you're going to be the kind one in the room. I need you to live for me. And it's tough, and I blow it. And you've blown it, and we've all blown it. When people are telling those awful jokes in the office, we denied him. We failed him. Jesus says it's okay. It's okay, I still need you right now, and I see your future, and your future is bright, and today you failed, and tomorrow you didn't fail. And in fact, years from now, you will have done some amazing things for the kingdom. And that's the choice that we have for tonight. I can't tell you your future, but God already knows it. And if you take the step of faith to sacrifice everything like Abraham did, to flee sin like Joseph did, to not leave your heart in the world like Lot's wife did, to not be afraid of the challenges that God sets before you like Jonah did, you can have a wonderful future. The battle is already won. And if you've messed up like Peter, it can still be okay. God still has a plan and a future for you, and he's begging, he's pulling you by the hand like he did with Lot's family. Come on. We got to go. We got to get out of this nasty world. We got to get on to something better. There's a place. This place is perishing. Let me take you to some place that's better. Let me show you the amazing future you have. Let me show you that you're all going to be okay. Let me show you the example that you're going to be setting for generations to come. God says, you can do it. I've already seen it happen. But the choice to capture that future is up to us. If you aren't a child of God, your future isn't very bright right now because you haven't put Christ on in baptism. But there is some great potential. There is a trajectory. You're here right now tonight. That's a great first step. Putting on Christ in baptism, having your sins washed away, that's an even greater step. That's an even greater trajectory. And if you are a child of God, but like Peter, you've messed up badly, you have the opportunity to get back on the right track. And you have an opportunity to fix your future, because it's okay. God still has plans for you. God still needs you. And he knows he needs who you are, and he needs who you will become. And that future is really bright. If you need to come confessing sin, or if you need to come to put Christ on in baptism, whatever your need may be, please do so as together we stand and sing.